You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 16th of September, 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live today at radioalbion.com because we have with us geopolitical analyst Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from rusjournal.org. Matt, good day, sir. How is life for you today?
I'm not 100% sure, but I think my last Orthodox Nationalist, I said it was December. I don't remember. I think I did. I think I said it's like December 15th or something like that. It tells you just how exhausted I am. I'm pretty sure I said that. So if anyone is listening, I probably have flipped my lid entirely.
Wishful thinking, I think. Perhaps you're looking forward to Christmas. I listened to it yesterday and I didn't pick up on that. I do check all the podcasts out that we have here at Radio Albion, and it seemed perfectly fine to me. We have had a few problems with the audio recently, but now I hear you have a new computer, so all the audio problems should be finally done away with. We should have good sound today, and I'm sure your listeners will be pleased to hear that. But today we're going to be getting into a new report that has just come out. It's a new report on fraud in paying for the Afghan war. It's titled Profits of War, Corporate Beneficiaries of the Post-911 Pentagon Spending Surge. And it was produced by William D. Harting Center for the International Policy Department at Brown University. And this is pretty hot off the presses, actually. This is just 3 days old. They say the political climate created by the global war on terror, as it was referred to in the early 2000s, set the stage for large increases in the Pentagon budget, much of which went to military contractors. This spending surge included increases in the base budget, the portion of the budget not strictly related to ongoing conflicts, as well as trillions in spending on the United States post-9/11 wars. The base budget is relevant to sustaining a large military with a global reach, including over 800 overseas military bases and massive nuclear weapons capacity. The increases in the base budget have been over and above the $2 trillion in direct costs of the wars themselves that were expended through the Pentagon's Overseas Contingency Operations account. So basically, the extraneous stuff besides the wars themselves is actually now costing them more than the war itself. All of these wars together, I guess this is going over the last 20 years, isn't it? It's going back to the year 2000, and they're basically saying that the extras have cost more than the wars themselves. What do you make of this, Matt?
Well, you know, I harp on the lack of any distinction between public and private sectors. And this is what got me started on it, because most of this money isn't going to a government agency like the military, because even most of that has been privatized. Most of this money is going into the public sector, who works on behalf of the U.S. government. Now we have the situation where they are the U.S. government, and that's going to go into lobbying and everything else. The hard and fast distinction doesn't exist anymore. You don't find that in Russia or China at all. You don't find that in most of the world. But 800 overseas military bases, and don't forget, the American defense budget is not quite $1 trillion. We know that isn't true, though, because there's so many things. We've talked about it on this show. So many things that are not on budget. They put it elsewhere to avoid any kind of congressional opposition. They have military spending in almost every department, every committee. So this is just the things that they're talking about. We've also harped. If you go to my Patreon page, I have about 10 articles talking about this stuff long before these papers came out in terms of incompetence, The inability to audit the Pentagon, which we've talked about quite a bit. There's laws on the subject that don't get enforced. The corruption is so overwhelming to think that it wouldn't be applied to Afghanistan, where Johnson's law is so blatant. Johnson's law can be used here because most people have no idea what's going on over there. They don't know how to judge it. The military has been depicted as the supermen, bizarrely enough. So it's really hard for anyone, even intelligent people, to come to any kind of judgment. So it's the temptations are overwhelming. And as always, it's always worse than you think it is.
Well, you bring up corruption there, and we're used to thinking of the third world as corrupt, but this is quite incredible, and this is going on in America now. Total Pentagon expenditures for all purposes since fiscal year 2001 have topped $14.1 trillion, and that's measured in 2021 dollars. Of this sum, $4.4 trillion went for weapons procurement and research and development, categories that primarily benefit corporate contractors. The remaining funds went to pay and benefits for military and civilian personnel and supporting expenditures needed to operate and maintain the US military. The $4.4 trillion figure is a conservative estimate of the pool of funding Pentagon contractors have drawn from in the two decades since 9/11. The Pentagon's massive budget for operations and maintenance also subsidizes contractors, but it is harder to determine what share of this category goes to private firms. The benefits of the post-9/11 surge in Pentagon spending have been highly concentrated. One quarter to one third of all Pentagon contracts in recent years have gone to just five major weapons contractors: Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman. One quarter to one third of all Pentagon contracts in recent years have gone to just five major weapons contractors: Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman. These five companies received over $286 billion in contracts in the fiscal year 2019 and the fiscal year 2020 alone. From financial year 2001 to financial year 2020, these five firms alone split over $2.1 trillion in Pentagon contracts. And to put these figures in perspective, the $75 billion in Pentagon contracts received by Lockheed Martin in financial year 2020 is well over 1.5 times the entire budget for the State Department and Agency for International Development for that year, which totaled $44 billion. So twice as much is just going on this Lockheed Martin alone. It's no surprise that they are doing so well in the stock market, is it, these five firms? The picture that I've actually got for the article today is to do with something else, and it's listing these exact same five firms as being the best firms to invest in because they're getting all this money out of the Pentagon, I guess. And Matt, what are your thoughts?
Oh, my God. This is what the frightening aspect of all of this is, that besides the fact that all the post 9/11 wars have been lost badly, these contractors, who are far more powerful than the government as such, are now going to be looking for other places. And I hate to think that, you know, China is going to be. I mean, we're hearing things from that so-called Biden administration almost every day, including from the military, about declaring war on a country that in no respect threatens the U.S. And that certainly, I mean, if the U.S. can't defeat the Taliban, which of course I predicted 20 years ago, with no lessons learned, no lessons learned from its own failures or the Soviet failures, how in heaven's name is it going to defeat a massive and highly motivated military force like China and all of their allies? Now, these firms, General Dynamics, Raytheon, they have subcontractors everywhere. They're outsourced all over the planet, including in China. They're everywhere. So how, you know, any kind of a total war in World War II sense, a total war is geographically impossible, since so many of these companies are invested all over the planet. That means American materiel, military equipment, is being produced, at least pieces of it, components of it, everywhere, including places in China and India and even Vietnam, because profits are the only thing that matter. When you have a state-centered military complex like in Russia or China, most of the third world, they're not third world, but most of the, you know, in smaller countries, you don't have the profit motive. And this is one of the reasons you don't have an empire. And this is one of the reasons that they keep costs very low and still have a superior military system. They're not, officers are not there to get their college paid for or for prestige or because they have nothing else. They're there and they have a strong patriotic motivation. There's a completely different way that these kids are raised. The Pentagon has lowered standards both for mental, for criminality, obesity, to the point now this is really becoming not just a joke but a dangerous one. And it's making a mockery of those who are actually competent in that area.
Well, I think I can hazard a guess as to how they would wage this war just by throwing more dollars at it. Cost overruns and poor performance characterized much of the work involved in rebuilding Iraq. Large US firms like Parsons and Bechtel were cited for inadequate and incomplete work on scores of projects, involving everything from water projects to building schools and health clinics. According to a September 2006 New York Times account of an investigation by the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, 13 out of 14 projects carried out by Parsons in Iraq were substandard, with construction deficiencies and other serious problems. One of the projects involved the construction of a police college in Baghdad, where plumbing work was so poor that the pipes burst, dumping urine and fecal matter throughout the college's buildings. This is America building this. I mean, this is the sort of thing that you would joke about happening in India or maybe happening in Africa, and this is Americans building substandard infrastructure in these countries that drop urine and fecal matter all through the college's buildings. I mean, this is scandalous, Matt. 13 out of 14 projects were up to the were down to this standard. What do you know about this group?
Well, the special inspector, in this case for Iraq reconstruction, the one for Afghanistan reconstruction just came out last month. And I've also read this, and it's all the same. And remember, this is a military-sponsored group. It has a military seal on it. So you know it has to be far worse than what they're willing to admit, because this is right from the horse's mouth. These companies don't have an incentive to do well. Their only incentive is to cut costs to the – and most of these bids are non-competitive. They're illegal in almost every respect, but they're on the other side of the world. They could always blame the locals, you know, also third world, what do you want, even though it's their fault. And even worse, they could blame the U.S. government, because in the press, it's not normally referred to as a private contractor. The U.S. did X, Y, and Z. U.S. military did X, Y, and Z. So their incentive, they don't even have to take blame. Only now, as these reports have come out very recently, and then, of course, the Iraq one came out in 05, 06. But that, you know, that's not something that you hear about every single day. These get some media attention. They're quickly forgotten. I mean, they're too long for the average American to read. They simply have no incentive financially. They know the money's never going to stop. And the worship of the military means that they're not going to be questioned by too many people. And so that means you have this massive and don't forget, and I should have mentioned this before, BlackRock has a piece of all of these firms. So this is going right to one, you know, Israel first organization that has at least a piece in all of these, controls entire stock markets. And so, you know, far more powerful than the U.S. government. They also control banks, central banks around the world. So foreign policy is being made by them, especially when you have this, to put it nicely, the impaired so-called president of the U.S. who doesn't know where he is. He's the perfect person. He's like the Boris Yeltsin of America, where it's so easy to blame him. Like the Republican idiots are trying to blame him for the defeat in Afghanistan, as if he knows where it is or that he had anything to do with the policies there, even though he was a hawk under Obama. Being able to, you know, privatize profits and socialize costs is really what modern American capitalism is all about.
So they can just blame America when it all goes wrong. Well, that was Parsons and Bechtel in Iraq. In Afghanistan, DynaCorp was a primary contractor on a $20 billion State Department program to train and develop the Afghan police force between 2002 and 2017. Although poor supervision by the State Department was a significant part of the problem, DynaCorps bears some responsibility for the failure to help foster an effective Afghan police force during its tenure as the primary trainer. By 2010, only 30,000 of the 170,000 Afghans trained through the program were still on the police force. In addition, only 17% of the districts the IG reviewed were able to carry out law enforcement operations independently, and Ambassador Richard Holbrooke publicly stated that the Afghan police were an inadequate organization riddled with corruption. Are they anything like the army that we've seen practicing their star jumps, Matt? Do you know, what are the Afghan police force like?
I don't think it's there's much of a difference. The American occupiers are seen just like that. They're seen as occupiers with no right to be there, who are arrogant, who have absolutely nothing but contempt for Afghan traditions, who, as we've been saying for a long time, now they're finally admitting know absolutely nothing about the society there. They honestly believed, under the Bush administration, that they're going to walk in there and everyone is going to welcome them. Finally, we get civilization and liberalism. Finally, we get legal abortion. Finally, thank God. That's what actually they thought this. And they came in, they imposed all of that. They imposed, you know, affirmative action, putting women in charge of Afghan units. I mean, stupid things like this, having no clue that this might be a problem for them at many levels. And this is one of the big reasons why they lost. Well, because we have nuclear weapons and high tech, therefore we're going to win. Apparently having no clue about how military victory is won. They went up against a motivated, experienced, religious, fanatical in the best sense, opponent. Well, they're there for anything but those things. They're there for money and prestige. They had no right to be there. They were aware that they had no right to be there. Plus the fact that they're associated with the heroin trade. And that's, you know, that was a big part of the motivation. No one took them seriously. The military admission for the Afghan reconstruction goes on and on about the total ignorance about local conditions. You know, building a police station using Americans Disabilities Act, you know, they have to have ramps for wheelchairs, despite it being in the middle of nowhere on a mountain where you couldn't get a wheelchair up there anyway. All these, you know, liberal requirements having nothing to do with Afghan circumstances, with an ideology that's totally alien to them. And the Taliban, of course, had the traditional way of doing things. And this is a huge reason why they won. Anyone who pays attention knew that they would win. We were talking about this kind of stuff, God, years and years ago. This is nothing new to us, but the average American is reading this for the first time, if he reads it at all.
Well, the number of personnel deployed and the revenues received by security and reconstruction contractors grew dramatically as the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan wore on. The Congressional Research Service estimated that by March 2011, there were more contractor employees in Iraq and Afghanistan, 155,000, than there were U.S. uniformed military personnel, 145,000. In its August 2011 final report, the congressionally mandated Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan put the figure even higher, stating that contractors represent more than half of the U.S. presence in the contingency operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, at times employing more than a quarter million people. What are the sort of things that they were doing over there then, these contractors, Matt? I mean, I sort of imagine them just sort of building McDonald's or maybe working in gender-neutral studies at the universities or something. What are they actually doing over there?
Well, they are imposing those kind of institutions and that ideology, having no clue that maybe this is going to be rejected. They made no effort to understand local conditions. But if anyone wants to think that combat operations and combat support was not in the private sector, they're absolutely dead wrong. I think Americans have a real tough time wrapping their brain around the fact that a lot of combat organizations were done by mercenaries. The U.S. doesn't have a draft. It was, manpower has always been a problem, both quality and quantity. Desertion, I think I'm the only one to write at length about the massive desertion problem that the U.S. has in its own forces over there. But as far as the Afghan National Army and police, it's something like 30% every year. They know that this, you know, they're going to be there for a while. And we talked about the police department a few minutes ago. They know that, you know, 30% a year, that's their attrition rate. Afghans realize that the U.S. is a colonial occupier, so who's going to join that force? These are people who've already been kicked out of their villages for bad behavior. These are drug addicts. These are people who want to get involved in the heroin trade. They know the U.S. is a place to go. There's video after video on YouTube that I've cited before showing how the Americans are training these people. And it's comedy. I thought it was satire for a while. They're absolutely awful soldiers with no motivation. And the minute the Taliban shows up, they either join them or desert. But the American desertion rate is a huge problem. Although poor supervision by the State Department, this is right in the quote here. The relationship of the private contractors to federal government or the military itself is still vague. You know, to what extent is the U.S. government responsible for what a contractor does? That chain of command is still vague, especially in a country as large as Afghanistan, especially when you have huge private sector companies with a voice in Washington and a voice in the big banks who are doing this dirty work. That's how we know that the casualty rate there is far higher than anyone realizes. We have no idea how many of these combat operations were done by American actual regulars and how many were done by mercenaries. And the coordination between the two is almost non-existent. You add the Afghan National Army on top of it and the drug trade, it's, you know, it doesn't take a genius.
Well, it explains where all those millions of dollars came from that the ex-president took out of the country with him when the Taliban came into Kabul. A few examples of wasteful spending in Iraq and Afghanistan give a sense of how business was conducted throughout the war period. In Iraq, one of the early scandals involved overcharging for fuel supplied to US forces by Kellogg, Brown, and Root. In a December 2003 report, less than a year into the war, the Defense Contract Audit Agency documented tens of millions in overcharges by KBR, including charging more than twice what other suppliers were charging for fuel. 26 KBR's fuel overcharges were followed a few years later by similar price gouging by a firm called International Oil Trading Company, which received contracts worth $2.7 billion from the Defense Logistics Agency. An investigation by Representative Henry Waxman, Democrat, chair of the House Government Oversight and Reform Committee, found that the firm had routinely overcharged the Pentagon for fuel it brought into Iraq, making over $200 million in profits on sales of $1.4 billion during the period from 2004 to 2008, over a third of which allegedly went to its owner, Harry Sargent III, who also served as the finance chairman of the Florida Republican Party. Waxman summarized the situation as follows. The documents show that Mr. Sargent's company took advantage of U.S. taxpayers. His company had the only license to transport fuel through Jordan, so he could get away with charging exorbitant prices. I've never seen another situation like this. Well, hang on a minute. What are they doing importing fuel into Iraq in the first place? Isn't Iraq full of oil? Matt, what do you make of this?
That's completely symbolic of these failures here that any fool could have seen 20 years ago. You destroy the infrastructure of a country. You try to rebuild it purely on a for-profit basis with total ignorance, probably not only at home, but in the federal government who you're ostensibly working for in the first place. What are you going to do? Again, no incentive to do anything right. Now, Henry Waxman is one of the most disgusting liberals on Capitol Hill, and of course was a big fan of this war, and this never became really front page news, or if it were, it wasn't to be understood, because you still, now this is fading, the worst of the U.S. military is something that I noticed all of a sudden, especially after 9/11, from the Vietnam contempt for it to the 9/11 worship of it. It's either one or the other, apparently. And then you also notice the worship of the military is it may be fading, but this is a certain way it protects them. I've been criticizing these guys for a long time, and with the idiots out there, the first thing they say to me is somehow you're against the troops, which, you know, is probably true, but they don't know how to reason about these things. I mean, they still think that the military is this conservative institution fighting communists in Cambodia. they live in a dream world. But all of these, you know, elites, they're all, it's a revolving door, whether it be political parties, corporate America, government, oversight. It's, and now with a monopoly system in place, there's really nothing, no one's been arrested here. Nothing's really happened here. I think there was one $10,000 fine on one of these guys for this kind of thing. And it wasn't that long ago. In 2008, Staff Sergeant Ryan Massef, who was a Green Beret, who was electrocuted while showering in Iraq. That was the same company, the KBR. There were serious electrical problems noted a year before his electrocution. And no one did anything about it. I don't recall that being front page either. And they were using, you know, fly-by-night electricians, people who were, you know, lying on their resume. They didn't care. There was no real filtering system because there's no real incentive. I'm not sure how you could be electrocuted in a shower. How bad could that system possibly have been that those two things were even connected? And they knew it was bad. And they simply covered this up. And as far as I know, even when that was there, there was a testifying, someone testifying in front of Congress said even after that, nothing was done. But that's par for the course over here.
Well, as you mentioned there, it's the revolving door system that facilitates all this corruption. The arms industry has ample tools at its disposal to influence decisions over Pentagon spending going forward. The industry has spent $285 million in campaign contributions since 2001, with a special focus on presidential candidates, congressional leadership, and members of the Armed Services and Appropriations Committees in the House and Senate, the people with the most power over how much the country will be spending for military purposes. In addition, weapons makers have spent $2.5 billion on lobbying over the past two decades, employing on average over 700 lobbyists per year over the past 5 years, more than one for every member of Congress. The majority of these lobbyists have passed through the revolving door from jobs in Congress, the Pentagon, the National Security Council, or other key agencies involved in determining the size and scope of the annual budget for national defense. These revolving door hires use their connections to their former colleagues in government to advocate for their corporate employers, often to good effect from the standpoint of the arms industry. A report by the Project on Government Oversight found that there were 645 instances of the top 20 defense contractors hiring former senior government officials, military officers, members of Congress, and senior legislative staff as lobbyists, board members, or senior executives just in 2018 alone. In addition to having the inside track on influencing decisions making on defense, government personnel who pass through the revolving door may give special treatment to contractors while they are still in government in the hopes of landing lucrative positions with a defense contractor upon retirement from the government service. To cite just one of scores of these examples, former head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, who was a major booster of Lockheed Martin's troubled F-35 combat aircraft, joined the company's board just 4 months after leaving the military. These kinds of interactions raise serious questions about whether special interests or the national interest have the greater sway in determining US defense policies and procurement choices. I mean, this is no better than Afghanistan, isn't it? It's like the Afghan president and his brother runs the drug trade. You've got people that are in Congress here that just move out of Congress, work in the military, and then move back into Congress again. Have you heard of this guy before, Matt, this Joseph Dunford?
Yeah, and he's come up also in the military report as well. And they also, you know, the military is admitting this, that the revolving door, it swings in both directions. You have former government personnel going into industry, but industry take powerful positions in government. I mean, just off the top of my head, you have, you know, at least four of the past five or six defense secretaries in the U.S. came directly from one of the arms contractors. James Mattis, who I was an early critic of, was on the board of General Dynamics, I think. Patrick Shanahan was at Boeing. Esper, who we had a whole show on. Who was actually head of government relations at Raytheon. And then, of course, this, you know, character, Lloyd Austin, was a board member of the same company. This is how – and this is the case with most cabinet – actually all cabinet positions, things like the FDA at a lower level. These are all chosen because of their industry connections. to the point where there really is no concept of regulation, since it's certainly in these companies' interest to make sure they have people in government. And in the case of a general, their salaries, once they retire, are in the millions, while getting a massive pension, which has no income limits. So they could do whatever they want. They can make $1 billion a year and still get their full pension and 100% coverage for everything, not to mention public worship. And when you're worshiped like this, the American media has promoted the thank you for your service idiots. How do you think they're going to behave? You know, most people are terrified to criticize these guys. But some of these reports, if it makes it into the public arena, which it probably won't, are starting to chip away at that nonsensical, cartoonish, thanks for your service nonsense. And so, you know, there is no distinction, again, between corporate America and the state. So now even referring to those terms, especially now when it's all BlackRock at this point, it simply doesn't make any difference. Politicians are there to conveniently blame when anything goes wrong.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, there's also the convenient bogeyman from China and from Iran. The most recent surge in concern about Chinese military power was sparked by the Pentagon's 2018 National Defense Strategy, which targeted great power rivalry as the greatest threat to United States security and global influence. The National Defense Strategy was followed a year later by the congressionally mandated National Defense Strategy Commission, which rang an even louder alarm bell about the purported threat from China and proposed 3-5% annual growth in the Pentagon budget to address it. These threats were touted alongside, rather than instead of, existing perceived challenges like global terrorism and regional powers like North Korea and Iran. 9 of the 12 members of the commission had direct or indirect ties to the arms industry, a reality that no doubt had some influence over their deliberations and conclusions. The 3-5% growth rate has become a mantra of Pentagon budget hawks like Republican Senator James Inhofe, the ranking Republican on the Senate Armed Services Committee, who deployed it relentlessly as a critique of the Biden administration's more than ample proposal of over $750 billion for national defense. The Pentagon plus nuclear weapons development work at the Department of Energy, which, as just noted, is at one of the highest levels since World War II. Matt, what are your final thoughts on all of this?
Well, this is the worst part of it. Inventing this China threat, China has to strongly arm itself. It has a much larger navy than the U.S. Its infantry is better equipped. And they all have state-controlled material manufacturers rather than the for-profit organization. And, of course, you could always blame Biden or whatever politician you want at the time. And because there was total ignorance about the Afghanistan situation, there'll be total ignorance about China. They'll go to the liberals and say they're killing Muslims in the West and they're terrible reactionaries. They'll go to the conservatives and say, well, it's still the Communist Party. They're reds. We have to destroy them. They're doing that already. And when the regime goes to both sides, this make-believe political divide, you know that they're planning something. And the same ignorance will be used there as in Afghanistan. And if it actually goes down, the results are going to be completely disastrous.
Well, it can't just continue on forever, can it? Eventually, it is all going to fall in on itself. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Grandpa Dan will be here with you tomorrow for another episode of The Daily Nationalist. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.